I have a confession to make. I love the 4th of July. Now, I don't necessarily think I'm more patriotic than anybody else. I think the reason I love the 4th of July so much is because growing up, my family always made such a big deal out of it. We'd cook out, we'd have friends over, we'd enjoy hanging out with our neighbors, and we'd blow stuff up. A lot of stuff. I think that's the real reason I love the 4th of July. I love fireworks. I think the earliest memory I have of loving fireworks is when we were at my uncle and aunt's house for the 4th, shooting off all manner of things, most of which were not legal within city limits, but you didn't hear me say that. When one of the neighbors brought out one of those old metal coffee cans filled completely to capacity with bottle rockets. He'd tied all the fuses together and had one long fuse hanging out the bottom of the side of the can. When he lit it, it was like magic. Bottle rockets went everywhere. I was inspired. I've since held Roman candles in my hand while firing them high into the air. I've actually held one in each hand. I've lit bottle rockets in my hand and then held them to just the last second and tossed them up in time for them to shoot into the lake I was at and they'd explode underwater. And by the way, bottle rockets still explode underwater. It really is kind of cool. Now, I've timed mortar shell launches with my best friend, neither of us being particularly safe with our lighting, but the resulting show is pretty cool. I've lit strands of up to 32,000 black cats and watched with delight as they went off in beautifully chaotic fashion for over 10 minutes. He's like, brrr, go take a bathroom break, come back, brrr, go take a nap, come back, brrr. But perhaps my favorite memory of the 4th was watching fireworks explode over the Ohio River from the Abraham Lincoln Bridge separating Louisville, Kentucky from Jeffersonville, Indiana, when a really cute girl was pressed up right next to me, her hands gently touching for the first time, even though neither of us had acknowledged, even to ourselves, we had feelings for each other. And in case you're getting worried, I'm talking about my wife. Well, watching and participating in blowing stuff up, though, isn't the only reason I like the 4th of July. I'm also really proud of my country. In spite of warts and recent turmoil, we've had a bit of that lately, yeah? I am still thoroughly convinced that we live in the greatest nation in the world. Now, lots of nations have some sort of celebration of either their founding or their attaining independence or the rising to power of the current political dynasty. But what makes ours unique is that we're not just proclaiming, yay, our country's great. We're proclaiming, yay, our country is free. You see, freedom's a big deal in the world we live in today. It's a commodity that far too few people enjoy. Countless millions live with the illusion of freedom, but what they really have is the ability to run freely in the small box their government affords them. What we have in this country is something different, something richer, something deeper. Here's the thing about this incredible freedom. It has to be anchored to something even larger than itself. Here's the other thing. Understood properly, it does not exist for its own sake, but rather points forward to a freedom even deeper and larger than we can possibly imagine. And on this evening, when we're gathered to celebrate our great freedom together, I'd like to take just a few minutes with you to talk about this greater freedom. In order to do this, we're going to take a look at briefly at some things that Jesus said about what exactly freedom is and what obtaining it can do for us. Well, when the Apostle John wrote his gospel, he was writing about 30 years after the other guys died. And while he tells a couple of the same stories they did, he was writing for a different purpose and so included a number of different episodes. He also spent some time unpacking the final week of Jesus' life in more detail than the other guys did. Well, one of John's main concerns in his gospel is to present Jesus as fully God. To this end, he includes several key teaching blocks when Jesus revealed significant aspects of his divine nature to the people. One of these comes in John 8. In John chapter 8, verse 12, the apostle writes this. Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Now, this prompts an immediate debate with the Pharisees about Jesus' identity and mission. And Eventually, he points forward toward his eventual death on the cross as proof of the things he's claiming about himself. As he speaks, most of the Pharisees gather before him. They tune him out. They can't hear him. They're so stuck on the way they understand the world and God to operate that his words seem like so much nonsense to them. But there are some folks in the crowd who are interested. Listen to the things he's saying in light of some of the things he'd already done. They begin to think that, hey, maybe there's something to this Jesus guy after all. To this group, Jesus had something to say to encourage them forward in their journey. Check this out in verse 31 now. So Jesus said to the Jews who'd believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples. And you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Now, at first hearing, this just blows the minds of the folks gathered there. Their entire lives, they've been taught that they were something special, that they were free from the forces of the world because of their genetic heritage. Now, they didn't think of it in those terms, but that's what they were talking about. Because they were children of Abraham, they were free by birth. How is Jesus going to tell them then that they were free when they believed in his words? How could his words be greater than Abraham? He certainly wasn't, so they thought. But where they were speaking and thinking in purely physical terms, Jesus was talking about a deeper spiritual reality. The spiritual reality was that they were slaves to sin. The only way they were going to find real and lasting freedom was when they broke sin's power over them, and that was only going to happen when they committed themselves to his words, words which would eventually be given substance by his sacrificial death on a cross. Now, this is big stuff, but let's kind of narrow our focus into just this idea that knowing the truth is what makes us free. How is that? Well, what is freedom? It's fundamentally about having the ability to do as we please without anyone to stop us. But if we're honest, the kind of place we don't like to go to be very honest very often, all of us have the desire to do some things that would probably get us locked up if we actually followed through on them. In other words, if we did everything we pleased, we'd lose the ability to do as we please, most notably because there would be someone to stop us if we tried. Okay, so what's that mean? Well, it means that as long as we have those desires in us, we're not really free. As long as we have sin in us, to use the theological word for this, we're not really free. This is why a couple of verses later, Jesus says this, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin." So then, what do we do with this? Well, let's put this in somewhat different terms by jumping forward a bit and then working back to this place. If any society is going to be free, it cannot have many laws, and the state must be small. Think about why. The more laws that are on the books, the more things a person might want to do but can't without facing the threat of punishment. In other words, the more laws that are on the books, the less free we are. And the larger the state, the more laws it will be on the books because there's more people to make those laws. But think a bit further about why some society would have many laws on the books versus having fewer. Such a state of affairs stems from one of a couple of circumstances. Either the nation is ruled by an autocrat of some sort who genuinely believes he knows better than his people what's right and they need to be compelled to behave like he thinks they should behave. Or the character of the people has waned such that more and more are seeking to do things which are harmful to people, destructive of property, or just downright evil. When people won't do what is right of their own accord, the state has to encourage them in this direction by force of law, paired with the threat of punishment for breaking it. One way to put this is that if people are not naturally virtuous, if they do not naturally pursue ends and behaviors that are actively to the benefit of the people and places around them, they must be goaded in this direction to prevent the total breakdown of society. But just as freedom does not exist on its own or for itself, neither does virtue. Virtue has a source. That source is a faith in some God higher than ourselves. We'll be general for just a minute. Specifically, it requires faith in a God who's concerned with our day-to-day behavior and calls us to a higher standard than we would pursue on our own. Now, there are several different religions which offer some kind of a call to character. Only a very few, though, and one in particular, have impacted whole cultures to the good of the majority of their people. Christianity stands out as unique in this regard. It is not incidental that the rise of freedom on a global scale coincided with a relatively tiny slice of human history that began with a concerted effort to make the scriptures a central part of the life of as many people as possible. Furthermore, the only nation that is not only the freest in the world, but which has maintained this freedom longer than any other in the whole history of humanity, is the one that was founded on explicitly Christian ideals. The conclusion here that's truly inescapable is that there's some kind of a connection between the Christian faith and human freedom, both spiritually but also politically, when wise leaders make a genuine effort to see those ideals applied more broadly than on a personal basis. The impact is even greater when a majority of the people of that nation pursue the Christian faith in at least a cursory manner, and Christian character is held out as desirable and praiseworthy. It's no coincidence that as our nation has turned from its Christian heritage, the government has grown, laws have proliferated, and freedom has decreased to the point that battles over even basic expressions of freedom require court intervention to protect. But if this is a surprise at all, it should not be. With all of this in mind, consider again what Jesus said. If you abide in my words, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Freedom is found when we know the truth, and it's Jesus' words which point us to the truth. Why? Because it's Jesus' words which call us to die to self, to that part of ourself which desires sin and is thus held captive under its sway. It's Jesus' words which call us to find life by making him the Lord of our lives and unleashing the cleansing power of the Holy Spirit in us. It's Jesus' words which call us to love our neighbors and even our enemies. His words call us to leave behind fear and worry, trading them instead for faith and confidence in our Heavenly Father who loves us more than anything else in all of creation. His words call us to care more about what's wrong on the inside than what's right on the outside. His words call us to virtue, the kind of virtue that makes freedom possible. So, what do we do with all this? Two things. First, we live it. We want to see freedom sustained and expanded. We cannot rely on anyone else to do what it takes to see this happen. Freedom requires virtue, which requires faith. Absent faith and virtue, there's no freedom. So, we make certain that we ourselves are living faith-filled, virtuous lives. We make the words of Jesus our constant companion and seek to apply them in every situation of our lives. If you cannot then sit there where you are and declare with confidence right now that you're a follower of Jesus, then you are not as free as you could be. Let me invite you here now to change that. Let Jesus walk into your life as Lord and walk yourself into the freest freedom you'll ever know. We teach our children and grandchildren to do the same. And this points actually to the second thing we can do. The more people who pursue this faith-filled life of virtue, the freer we will all be. If our neighbors aren't living like this, the natural thing to assume is that they don't know or understand it, because who wouldn't want this when they understood it? So let's help them understand it. The other way to put this is that we make disciples everywhere we go, kind of like Jesus told us to do. After all, Jesus himself said that his truest disciples are the ones who know the truth that brings freedom. So once we're sure we are his disciples, we call everyone around us to do the same thing. We do it with love and humility as our guides. We do it gently. We do it boldly. But most of all, we do it. This 4th of July, let us live the truth that makes us free. Let us call the world around us, starting with our friends and neighbors, to do the same. And let us live as free people who have a reason to celebrate. May God bless you as you pursue this. And may he bless this great nation as we strive not to forget it. May God bless this great nation as we seek him and the life that only he can bring. May God bless this great nation as we celebrate with gratitude the God who has made us free.